You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
So as you're most probably aware from the newsletter, the address that I'm giving today is titled Awareness of the Past and Valuing Those from Our Community Connected with It, which is quite a long title, isn't it? I thought maybe that's most probably even a little misleading in a way, because perhaps a more apt title would have been Awareness of the Energy that has developed this community into what it is today, the energy that maintains it and the energy that will sustain it and ensure its future. I like that one better, but it's long and not printable, I don't think. I'd just like to read at the beginning this passage from Prospects for the Unitarian Movement, which is in our library out there if anybody wishes to borrow it, edited by Matthew F. Smith. And this passage here, I think, is quite a good way to start. Fellowships need to be on their guard against two pitfalls if they are to survive and grow. The first is that it's all too easy, without loyalty to a chapel and its traditions, for them to become private clubs, where old friends meet and new arrivals find it difficult to form relationships. The second is that, without a long history to look back on, they have to form their own traditions, and these may have little or no connection with the general Unitarian tradition and its principles. A tradition, of course, like history, has no stopping point, and the Unitarian tradition continues to be created each and every day. But there is connection with the past, even if some aspects of the tradition become redundant and others are newly started. The necessity of being in relationship not only with each other within a fellowship, but also in relationship with other Unitarians, past and present, throughout the world, is even more crucial in a fellowship than in a congregation. I chose this slide representing the past, present and future as a cube formation rather than as a signpost, with past being that way somewhere, the present here and the future going out there, as if they're disconnected. I think in Western societies, perhaps more particularly than other societies in the world, we tend to compartmentalise things fairly well, particularly when it comes to history. You know, we have recorded history, so therefore, once it's recorded, it's kind of put into a box and left there. But rather than that, I would think, you know, the old analogy of being in a train and looking out the window as you're going along. Directly out from you is the present. If you look ahead in the train, there's the future coming, and if you look behind, there's the past. But they are all connected. And I think that's very much the same with our existence. Present, past and future are all linked. And if you look at some of the modern developments with DNA analogy, how the past affects DNA, DNA structure. They talk about memory implant on certain sections of the DNA that is passed on to the next generation and the next generation. And I think that's a clear signal that we aren't just this one isolated spot of time at the present. I mean, even as I'm talking now, what I've said 5 seconds ago has become the past. present is a fleeting thing, but we need to stay in it, as our meditation led us through this morning. I think it's also valuable for us sometimes as a community or an organisation to look back to the past and to see what has been given to us from the past, the valuable things. And so I'd like to take a look back at the past of this church, the Unitarian Church of South Australia. As comfortably as you can, I'm going to use this as a starting point. You don't have to do this, but if you're able to, I'm going to be referring to the windows at the back of the church, which are a strong part of the historical section of this church. They may seem, and I know to some they do, an anachronism because of their strong Christian flavour. The origin of stained glass windows in Christian cathedrals and churches came from a time in history when many of the people attending cathedrals or churches were illiterate, so they couldn't read biblical texts. And so the stained glass windows provided a way of showing the messages from the biblical texts in a way that people could understand, in a very visual way. I guess in a way it's an old form of animation that we like. So looking at the five windows, starting from the first one on the left, this window was a memorial to William Everard and Dr. Charles Everard, a son of Dr. Charles Everard, who brought his wife and children to the fledgling colony of South Australia in November 1836. So very early in the stage of settlement here, white settlement. They had brought land off the plan, much as some people do today with modern apartments, before it's even there. I think that's an amazing leap of faith to do that. The family members were Unitarians in England and were instrumental, when they came here, in helping to provide a solid basis for the establishment of this church. Charles gave a good deal of money in order for the church to buy land and build church in Wakefield Street, as well as pay for a minister. So before he left England, he actually bought two parcels of land, and as a reward, he was given by the South Australian Company another three sections of land that were right in the CBD of Adelaide, and one of them happened to be where the old church was in Wakefield Street. I'll tell you later a little bit about how that came to help the church even more. They held a meeting, and they needed, in the early days, they needed to raise, I think it was £400 for a minister to be brought out from England. That was a lot of money. And there were only a few people that were at that meeting, and they raised that money fairly quickly. So they must have been fairly well-heeled, some of the early Unitarians. Going back to William Everard, he became a member of the Legislative Council of South Australia, Commissioner of Lands and Minister of Education. His home, Ashford, situated on the Anzac Highway, was host to Sunday school and church picnics, as well as the occasional church service. Mount Everard in the Musgrave Ranges, Lake Everard, Everard Creek and Everard Park are all named after him. Going to the next window, in memory of William Kay, who was 20 years old when he migrated to South Australia in 1850. You can see that it mentions his wife, you can't see at the moment because I think the chair's in the way, died in 1906. And an unmarried daughter, Annie, is also mentioned on the window, and she died in 1890. He became a director of the ES&A Bank, which became part of the ANZ Bank. The AMP Society, he was a founding member of that, as well as president of the Adelaide Chamber of Commerce. He was on the board of the Adelaide Hospital and on various charity committees. He represented East Adelaide in the House of Assembly from 1875 to 1878. Added to this, he was a strong force in our church and was often a member of the Committee of Management and was frequently its president. In fact, it did say, because we have a rule, once you've held your office for 3 years, you have to then leave the committee and have a break. So he would take a break and then come back, I think, as soon as he possibly could. He and Sarah had 11 children, five of whom died in infancy. The middle window is the Clark Memorial window, and that is dedicated to Euphemia and Matthew Simons Clark. Euphemia came to South Australia in 1851 with her parents and seven siblings in order to escape official discrimination against people of dissenting religions. That meant if you were a Unitarian at that time in England, you weren't allowed to attend a university because you were Unitarian. She married Simons Clark in 1874, who had migrated in 1850 with his parents and seven siblings. It's interesting, number seven, seeking a more favourable spiritual and physical climate. That's an interesting facet too. The Clarks were lifelong Unitarians and their seven children were raised as Unitarians. This window was provided for in the will of their youngest daughter, who died as a Red Cross officer on the hospital ship Centaur in World War II when it was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine in 1943. Simons had stipulated that the window should depict the theme of mercy. It was designed and constructed by Simons' cousin, Nora Burden, who was also a lifelong member of this church. The second window from the right is related to the second window from the left, in that it is a memorial to Mrs. Annie Kay, who was the sister of William Kay's wife, Sarah. Annie was a staunch Unitarian and worked hard for the church. However, after her death in 1886, her husband and their children decided not to be Unitarians anymore and they joined the Anglican Church, or the Church of England at that time. The fifth window is a memorial to Alfred Simpson, who migrated to South Australia in 1849. The Simpson family migrated due to economic hard times in England. He had owned a business in England and it had caught fire, burnt to the ground, and they financially could not recover from it, so decided to come to South Australia to start a new life, but had little money when they arrived. Alfred worked on the roads when he first got to South Australia, and Sarah, his wife, cleaned houses. Alfred also joined the gold rush of 1851 with little success. Eventually, a legacy of £300 was sent from England from relatives there in the form of tin plate and tinsmith tools, enabling Alfred to begin a successful business as a wholesale tin man. The business continued to grow and was the foundation of the very successful Simpson family business, you know, the Simpson washing machines and dryers and refrigerators and all those white goods, but other things as well. Although the Simpsons were unable to contribute financially to the church, they were among its early supporters, and as the business prospered, they were able to contribute financially at a generous level. Alfred is a family name passed down through generations of the Simpson family. There was Alfred Muller, son of the aforementioned Alfred, and he was church secretary and treasurer, and his grandson and great-grandson were both treasurers for many years. Both Alfred and his wife Sarah's names are included on the window. Descendants are currently members of the church, as was Audrey Abbey. Many of the older members of the church here will remember. And she was a very staunch Unitarian and a guiding light for this church. She paid for those windows to be moved from the Wakefield Street Church to this building, as well as moving the organ as well. That was a total gift of $12,000 back in 1971. Quite a sizable sum. You could buy a house for that at that stage, just about. And it was a huge amount compared to the $72 a fortnight that I was being paid as a teacher at that time. It's not my intention to suggest that the founding members of our community mentioned were the only ones who contributed their energies to the maintenance and governance of this church. Naturally, there were many who have contributed to the well-being of the church, members who perhaps didn't rate in the notables list, but who in their own quiet way made a strong and lasting commitment to this community. The posters placed in the annex on the windows out there today were produced in 2005, and they give a whole lot of information about the history of the church. And I thought it was worthwhile to put them up there so that if, when you're having coffee, you might just like to glance over them. There was also a little booklet that we have in the back storeroom that was produced in 1997, and that outlines the history of the church. Naturally, the role of past ministers in guiding members was vital to the well-being of this community. And there have been many ministers of note in that journey of this church, and many address could be made of their contributions to the community. But today I'd like to concentrate on just one who provides not just history of the past, but a link to the present and to the future. He is a member of our community and as such is helping to frame the future of it. I'm talking about our Emeritus Minister Alan Kirby, who was minister from 1968 until 1984 and then from 1993 to 1995 as a development minister. During that time, he presided over two of the most profound changes in this church: the challenge of changing the name of the church by dropping the title Christian and the move from Wakefield Street to Osmond Terrace. Instead of being known as the Unitarian Christian Church of South Australia, the title is the one we have currently today, the Unitarian Church of South Australia, and was adopted, however, by the congregation, but this process took between 1 to 2 years to achieve, with many meetings and discussions, sometimes, I believe, quite heated. The move from Wakefield Street took much longer. And the history behind that is that by the 1960s, the church in Wakefield Street was in need of a good deal of costly major repair work and was proving too expensive to maintain. And I quote this section here: "The Reverend Alan Kirby was the moving spirit in arranging the sale of the old church and the manse in Wakefield, as well as purchasing the land on which our current meeting house stands. He obviously led this transition well, as it is stated in the 1994 booklet on the history of the church. The congregation was solidly supported of him in spite of their deep attachment to their original church. However, when the new church was completed, the financial situation of the church was dire. There was no money left. They could not afford to move the stained glass windows or the organ, and that's why Audrey's Abby's gift helped. And they couldn't afford to buy the benches that are here today that we're sitting on. And so Alan asked the congregation or members of the congregation if they would be willing to purchase a bench each. And they did that willingly. After the move into this building, the finances were very dire, so Alan offered to take leave without pay. While he was away, interim ministers from the US and Britain covered his absence, and the church was lucky enough not to have to pay them a stipend. This support came from the UUA and the GA and enabled the church to rebuild its finances. When Alan returned, he voluntarily reduced his stipend in order to further strengthen the financial situation of the church. He maintains his commitment to our community now and expends energy for this community as a member, as well as being Emeritus Minister, member of the Finance Subcommittee, and partaking in pastoral visitation. So the past, the present, and the future are linked there. Having mentioned pastoral visitation, I wonder if we have a similar idea of what that term means. Pastoral care is what I'm talking about. Here are a couple of definitions that might help. Pastoral care is an ancient model of emotional and spiritual support that can be found in all cultures and traditions. It has been described in our modern context as individual and corporate patients in which trained pastoral carers support people in their pain, loss, and anxiety, and their triumphs, joys, and victories. That's a definition from Canberra University Multi-Faith Centre. Another one states, the term is considered more inclusive of distinctly non-religious forms of support, as well as those from religious communities. That was from Helen Mulholland in The Guardian on February 2018. Sometimes pastoral care is seen in the narrower confine of the pastor's care. There are many assumptions about what a pastor's care is. Commonly, a pastor's main job is to preach messages in mainline Protestant churches. But in addition to preaching sermons, pastors are also expected to be involved in local ministries such as hospital chaplaincy, visitation, funerals, weddings, and organising religious activities. Pastoral care is therefore both encouraging their local congregation and bringing new people into the church. That is not to say that the congregation is not to be involved in both activities, but that the pastor is the leader of these activities. From my observations of the interactions of our members in this community, after services on Sunday, as well as other groups involving members, it is obvious to me that many members take the role of pastoral care seriously and make huge efforts to support and connect with other members. Some of our members, however, are unable to attend services due to such things as ill health, injury, or old age, or simply going through a particularly challenging time in their life. These obviously need special extra consideration. In 2015, Christine Mason felt quite strongly that there was a need to establish a pastoral care team of interested people, members, that would coordinate the needs for ongoing pastoral care within our community. This idea of a designated group was not a new concept to this community, but hadn't existed for some time. Individual members had carried this task, but it was thought that these efforts should be coordinated as there was the obvious risk of some members needing pastoral care not being covered. The pastoral care group meets every 3 months, but communicates regularly via emails, texts, and phone calls. Members of the group are Jenny Dyster, Christine Mason, Sandy Schultheis, Helen Hall, and myself. We share information about members requiring contact, as well as who we have made contact with and how many times and for what purpose, obviously respecting the privacy of those contacted and only sharing information about their circumstances that they allow. So I just ask you, if you have a concern about anyone or are aware of a member of our community who might benefit from contact from a member of the pastoral care team, please contact one of us. Through our efforts as a team, we are finding it a rewarding way of sharing our energy with this beloved community. Now, I'm not putting the pastoral care group as the only group of energy providers within the church. There are so many organisations within the church where people expend a lot of energy in one way or another, and you can find those examples by looking in the information about the church and the number of groups that we are involved in. So I don't want to list them all because I'm frightened if I do that, I'll miss somebody out and offend somebody. I don't want to do that. All of these activities, though, require time from their contributors as well as energy. This all adds up to the positive energy that is present in this dwelling and is something that the forebears of this church would be pleased to see continuing. But the question could be asked, is what we are doing enough to ensure that there is a future for this community? Many of us are an ageing population, generally speaking, I guess, and we will deplete our energy stocks if we are, who are so few, attempt to do so much. I think that's a fear that goes with that. I just ask Helen now to come forward and read some words from Deepak Chopra from his book, The Book of Secrets.
When we think, I don't want to expend all my energy, this decision revolves around a belief that energy, like money in your bank account, is limited. Some people who don't want to spend much energy avoid new challenges out of laziness, but that is mostly a disguise for deeper issues. It's certainly true that energy is limited. But if you have ever committed yourself passionately to anything, you've found that the more energy you devote to it, the more you have. passion replenishes itself. What drains energy, strangely enough, is the act of holding back. The more you conserve your energy, the more narrow become the channels through which it flows. The less energy you spend, the less you have to spend. Here are a few steps that can cause channels of energy to expand. Firstly, learn to give. When you feel most like hoarding, turn to someone in need and offer some of what you possess in abundance. This doesn't have to be money or goods. You can give time and attention, which actually will do much more to open your channels of energy than giving away cash. Secondly, be generous. This means generous in praise and appreciation even more than generous with your money. Most people hunger for praise and get much less than they deserve. Be the first to notice when someone has done well. Appreciate from a full heart and not just with formulaic words. And lastly, follow your passion. Some area in your life makes you want to spend all your energy there. Be willing to go to the limit and then go a bit further. Energy is the carrier of awareness to come out into the world. By devoting more energy to any endeavour, you increase the reward of understanding that will come to you.
Thank you, Helen. Hugh McKay, who we heard last year at the ANGEL conference, in his book Beyond Belief says, look around the world at all the factors contributing to our rising levels of anxiety. Civil wars, the threat of international terrorism, climate change, global economic fragility. The most powerful country on earth, the US, is in debt to the tune of trillions of dollars with its major creditor, China, regarded as a geopolitical rival. And all this accompanied in Western countries by a recurring complaint about the lack of vision among political leaders, how current is that, whose courage and integrity seem compromised by their short-term obsession with re-election. All this, he claims, leaves people searching for the consolations of spiritual life. He also claims that due to the growing feeling of turmoil, upheavals and anxiety, we will further seek answers to the questions of why are we here? How should we live? Does it all mean anything? A church like ours surely stands ready to aid those seeking answers to these age-old questions. And I'd just like to read something written by Jane Brooks back in 1993. Unitarians may not be proselytisers, but that does not mean that we will not grow in number. In order to grow, we do not have to try to convince anyone that they are following the wrong path, as the proselytisers do. Instead, we need to make our philosophy more widely known so that those people who have already convinced themselves they are following the wrong path have the option of joining us as we follow our own paths. As a community of members who share a common spiritual journey, not being bound by the idea that we have found the one true answer, we are well placed to aid others in their own individual spiritual journey. All we need is the energy to ensure that we continue on that journey and through our efforts assist others who we will meet as we travel along our journeys. Carl Jung wrote in 1961, and this was quoted in Hugh McKay's book, in memories, dreams, reflections, not only do I leave the door open for the Christian message, but I consider it of central importance for Western man. It needs, however, to be seen in a new light in accordance with the changes wrought by the contemporary spirit. Otherwise, it stands apart from the times and has no effect on man's wholeness. This church has moved a long way from its traditional Christian roots. However, it maintains the values of this heritage as seen in our seven principles, but embraces a much broader sphere of spiritual thought and practice. The challenge for us is to ensure that our passion for this community translates into the energy, no matter what form that takes, to ensure that the foundation provided by our spiritual ancestors is built upon for the benefit of the wider community in which we live. Do you like the school teacher type slide there? The old chalkboard. That was from a Filipino school, but I think it has a fairly strong message for us. These words written by Daphne Treloar, also found in a Southern Chalice. The peace at being at one. As we leave this place, may we take with us the peace of being at one with the world and with all humanity. May we regard every contact as precious, every opportunity as unique, and live every moment as we would our last. Amen.
We hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.